On today's episode of The Encrypted Economy, we tackle digital asset taxation. Now, this episode is not going to be highly technical or one that's filled with citations, so don't be scared. It's rather a mental model for thinking about digital assets, whether from a commercial sense of investing or engaging as a participant, what have you. It's meant to cover a number of different frameworks and buckets. So Jason has a knack for breaking down complicated concepts into digestible frameworks. And this is very helpful for today, because even though I can get a bit nerdy on these episodes, this one I really wanted to make sure we didn't get too deep and stayed more at the forest level with noting some trees along the way. Sometimes people get lost in the citations. And for tax, it's hard to do a podcast without it. So I think today is a mark of honor that we've been able to pull something off that I think will be helpful to anybody who's listening to it, who's interested in, hey, how are these things taxed? So nothing on this podcast, nonetheless, is legal advice or tax advice, and the IRS may not agree with any of it. But nonetheless, as a framework for contemplating digital asset taxation, I think it's pretty compelling. So I hope you get a lot out of this episode. I was really excited with the way it turned out. So if you like it, share it, get it out there, because the encrypted economy, we're adding value to the way that people think about the encrypted economy. And despite whatever goes on in the digital asset marketplace, digital assets are here to stay. And so is the encrypted economy. Enjoy. Welcome to The Encrypted Economy, a weekly podcast featuring discussions exploring the business, laws, regulation, security, and technologies relating to digital assets and data. I am Eric Hess, founder of Hess Legal Counsel. I've spent decades representing regulated exchanges, broker-dealers, investment advisors, and all matter of fintech companies for all things touching electronic trading, with a focus on new and developing technologies. On The Encrypted Economy today, we're really excited to have Jason Schwartz, partner at Fried Frank, focusing on tax, but he's more than just a tax lawyer. He's a crypto lawyer who's got a lot of expertise in the ability to apply tax to crypto. So Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I'm going to point out, just because it's so, I got on the podcast today, and Jason's wearing a blazer, and what's the shirt? Help me out with the shirt.
This is my cryptode number 761, which I own. My NFT.
His NFT. So he's got his NFT. I don't have an NFT emblazoned on my shirt. And in fact, I was wearing a collar shirt, but then I'm like, if he's going to wear that, I got to find something. So I grabbed probably the closest thing I got, which is a Minecraft T-shirt, which I'm wearing. And I don't even play Minecraft.
You've got to up your NFT game, though. I mean,
I got to work on it. I got to work on it.
I only have one profile pic NFT, and it's this cryptode. I was scammed out of it at one point. And then was able to recover it. So it's near and dear to my heart. But other than that, I collect a lot of the long form generative art stuff, like the art block stuff.
The NFT with the story, that's what people are counting on. So Jason, why don't you give us your Genesis block, so to speak, a little bit about you, your background, how you got into digital assets.
Yeah. So I've been practicing law for a while now. I was a partner at another law firm before Fried Frank, recently moved to Fried Frank. And the majority of my work in my career to date has been in the TradFi space. So a lot of securitizations, a lot of fund formation, a lot of financial products. And during the course of my work for, asset managers and financial institutions, I came across crypto a couple of years ago, I guess. And as soon as I started looking into it, it started with just sort of like curiosity. I just wanted to know a little bit more than my clients knew. And then as soon as I started looking into it, I just, was totally enthralled by the whole field. So, not only did I get into, DeFi degenning on my own, but also, into the like NFT and art world. It's kind of makes sense, because I'm looking around myself. I have like tons of art on my walls in my home. So it just sort of comes naturally that I would be interested in collecting in the virtual world as well. I think that the tax law raises so many important issues for us in crypto. And crypto, I think, challenges the very foundations of our tax law, that this is going to be sort of one of the next big challenges for policymakers and for, everyday people trying to navigate the landscape.
Excellent. So now we're going to get into it. So tax law is something that strikes fear in the heart of many, not just attorneys, everybody who has to deal with it every year, but you know, there's so many different ways to cut up taxes. It's funny, when I first got into crypto, I forget, it was like 2015. I wish I would have gotten learned about it sooner. And words like Kraken, I'm like, sea monster, I'm never gonna, now Kraken's like my number one thing. And somebody said, I'm gonna put you in a white paper, because I was doing stuff with digital assets. I just wasn't, and I was like, a white paper. And I had like my own, I'm like, white paper, what's a white paper? I mean, how can a white paper be bad? It's just a white paper, it's a paper, right? And I remember, like, finally when I got to looking at it, like, I was oblivious. Like, I just kind of thought it was meaningless. And they're like, I give you a token. I'm like, okay, sure, whatever, right? And then they finally said, we want you to look at this thing. And I'm like, this is an offering document, right? That was my first reaction. I'm not saying all white papers are offering documents. I'm just saying that the white paper I saw was a white. And I tore the thing to shreds. But the point was, I think taxes in many ways that way, like, you know, we have this thing, we have NFTs, we have DAOs, and we want to say, well, no, it doesn't fall in the normal classifications. It's something new. It's different. Maybe taxes don't apply to it. But in fact, that's not the case. So I don't know whether that's a proper, segue.
But I think that is actually a perfect segue to what we're planning on talking about today, because you're right. I mean, I think in regulatory and tax, for example, any ordinary course of dealing between people is treated as an entity, right? So like you were talking about a white paper. Yeah, you have a few people who got together and put, you know, had this great idea, and they want to solicit investments to build out this great idea. And they anticipate that, like, if they get those investments, they can turn a lot of profit for the people who are investing, right? And that looks a lot like a securities offering. I obviously have no idea what, you know, whose white paper you're talking about. So, you know, I'm not giving legal advice or anything, but that's like a perfect example. And in tax law, there's an analog, which is, again, you know, any arrangement between people, where people are cooperating to sort of jointly earn profits and or split expenses is actually an entity for U.S. tax purposes that might require, you know, might have to pay its own taxes or have to file its own tax returns to tell, you know, U.S. people what taxes they owe or whatnot. So there are like huge implications depending on how people interact with each other on chain.
Right. So I guess we'll, you know, use the entity analysis, but before we get into sort of thinking of these vehicles in crypto and analogizing them to existing entities, appropriate analogizing potentially, I'd like to sort of start by basing it with, you know, everybody, even if you're not a tax lawyer, generally knows that partnership flows through corporation tax at the entity level. There's these LLCs, which is sort of a different creature, but they haven't been around for all that long, like, you know, a few decades. But let's just stay with corporations and partnerships and talk about why corporations and partnerships are taxed the way that they are.
Yeah. So I would say that they're sort of a couple of principles here that, you know, we want to keep in mind. So number one, it's just a historic principle, which is historically, you know, this country has always had what we call a classical corporate tax system. And what does that mean? It means that, like, if you take advantage of the country's sort of legal structures in a way to create, you know, a joint venture that is like liquidly traded, you know, publicly traded joint venture, then generally that entity has to pay its own tax, its own corporate tax. And Congress doesn't really care if that entity is wholly owned by U.S. people who are going to pay tax on the dividends when the profits are eventually dividended to them anyway. Congress also says, like, yeah, but this is a separate person for tax purposes. And even if it's really just represented by a slip of paper in someone's desk, you know, like some corporate charter, we're imposing corporate tax on that. So that's just a historical perspective that, like, the corporate tax has always been part of our tax system, at least, you know, since the early 20th century. And the government has a vested interest in protecting that because that's a huge portion of our tax revenues as a country. Okay. The other two principles are sort of these general principles that I think are worth, you know, someone new to, you know, to tax, like most of your listeners, I assume, just keeping in mind. And number one is that U.S. people, U.S. taxpayers have to pay tax currently on their share of, you know, any income or gain that they realize in the year. And that's, I'll unpack that a tiny bit. But what I mean by that is, like, if I hold property, right, and the property is appreciated, like investment property, like stock or crypto or whatever, and I sell it this year at a gain, I have to pay tax on that gain, right? It seems sort of obvious, but like Congress takes that and the IRS takes that kind of to an extreme in that, like let's say alternatively that I am the hedge fund Renaissance Technologies. I'm using a real example. Renaissance Technologies hired financial institutions, allegedly, and paid them this contractual payment in order for those financial institutions to trade a bunch of stocks and securities on its behalf, okay? And Renaissance Technology took the position that because they didn't directly hold the stuff, because like financial institutions held that stuff for them, they didn't actually have any tax, right? Because like they basically owned the single contract, the single investment contract that they had entered into with all these financial institutions. At the end of last year, Renaissance settled for like $7 billion or something with the IRS because the IRS asserted, and Renaissance Technologies lawyers apparently, you know, agreed at least on some level, that because those stocks and securities were being traded for Renaissance, Renaissance was really the owner and was really recognizing all that income and gain currently. They couldn't defer it, okay? So that's like, that's like principle number two, that U.S. people, if stuff is being traded by them or for them, they have to recognize income today. They can't defer that and treat their sort of indirect claim as some kind of like long-term capital asset. Number three, the last of these three principles, is that any U.S. business profits, so any profits derived from like feet on the ground in the U.S., you know, like a U.S. business, lemonade stand or banking or, you know, asset management or whatever, those business profits also have to be taxed to someone on a current basis. Okay, so what I mean by that is, like, let's say that a foreign person, like we say foreigners, it's not intended to be derogatory. That's actually the tax term. Non-U.S. people, a non-U.S. person.
Some foreigners would consider being a U.S. person derogatory.
There you go. Well, a foreigner hires me in the U.S. and I set up a lemonade stand for them. Or, like, more realistically, I set up a trading business for them. And I'm doing a bunch of trading on their behalf. In the U.S., boots on the ground in the U.S., those, you know, absent some statutory exception, are U.S. business profits, and the foreigner then is going to have to pay U.S. taxes on their income from it, because those are U.S. business profits taxed currently. So those are sort of the three things to keep in mind with the tax system.
Great. And you know, to kind of build on the theory, and I think it's important for the deemed analysis, even though deemed entity analysis, even though it may seem a little basic, is you know, the underpinnings of why corporates are taxed as separate entities, whereas partnerships are passed through. And I think the obvious, but just to restate it, because I think it is important in the analysis, is that because you're a corporation, you get certain privileges, you get certain benefits that you don't get as a partnership. One is this notion of limited liability. Now, LLCs sort of bridge that gap, and that's a kind of a different animal, but similar. It's like it has the benefits of both. But, you know, whereas a partnership, you don't have that because the individual partners are, you know, at least there's a general partner that is liable. So that's the trade-off. So on the one hand, you get the benefit. If you're in a partnership, you get the pass-through, so I only get taxed once. But if you're a corporation, you have limited liability. And of course, you also have the ability possibly to get lower taxes and to reinvest and not have to pay it at the income level. So there's benefits also for holding it in a corporate level. And it also kind of shields you depending on your tax liability in other jurisdictions.
It actually, so you've just combined like all three principles that I just discussed. So, you know, number one, this sort of historic preference for corporate tax. Number two, this idea that US people are taxed currently. And then number three, this idea that US business profits have to be taxed to someone. How did you combine them? Well, basically what you're saying and what's correct is, like, look, if you, Eric, and I, Jason, collectively decide to set up a business, you know, Congress gives us a little bit of leeway and says, okay, guys, like, you're a small business. You can be a partnership if you want. But that means that you each have to report in income currently your share of the partnership's income. So like, if the partnership earns 10 bucks and then you collectively decide to redeploy that 10 bucks into another investment, we don't really care that you don't have the cash. You still have to pay tax on that 10 bucks. So your tax currently, even though, you know, you haven't actually disposed of your partnership interest. But, you know, congratulations, we're not imposing an entity level tax. Okay. The alternative is, if you and I decide, well, we'd really love to like raise a bunch of money from all sorts of people all over the world. Then we might choose instead a corporate form, or we might be forced into choosing a corporate form. And in that case, the corporation would be a U.S. corporation subject to tax currently on its income, right? Like a separate person subject to tax. And we could then admit foreign, you know, foreign people as shareholders and have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shareholders who aren't taxed currently, but the corporation is, right? So the corporation is then a U.S. taxpayer paying taxes on its income. And then, of course, if it ever dividends out that income, we're subject to tax again. So those are the sort of two, you know, frameworks for dealing with income.
Right. So now I'm going to take another step, towing into the water, because I want to make sure that we set the groundwork for what we're going to dive into, because it's intriguing, but I also want to make sure people follow. Typically, I tell my listeners, I'm like, I don't, you know, it's fine. Try to listen. You can handle it. And I just, we go into it, but on this one, I want to make sure, because there's some very important points here. So, let's talk a little bit about, so there, again, with this notion of a deemed entity. So we use entities to sort of analogize that tax treatment, and maybe to just start off, we'll take an easy bite and we'll say, maybe it's not where the deemed entity analysis does not apply, but where for those instruments where we're not going to say that they're deemed entities, namely like if ETH, BTC, and let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll start to get into the deemed entities.
So let's talk about that. So you know, there are some assets that you can acquire that clearly don't, or maybe not so clearly, but you know, that I think clearly don't put you into, you know, a joint venture for profit with other people. Like, you acquire these assets and it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for the government to argue that you're somehow, you know, cooperating with others to earn a pooled profit and to pool your expenses. And two such assets are, you know, Ether and Bitcoin, right? Those look kind of like, no one really knows what they are for tax purposes, but most tax lawyers will tell you they're probably commodities for tax purposes, treated, you know, similarly to other fungible commodities like oil or gas or gold or silver, in that, you know, you buy them, and when you sell them, you know, as an individual, you're taxed on your capital gains or losses. And that's sort of it. They're fairly boring, in that sense, fairly simple as well.
Right. And I guess for foreigners too, you know, cause as we start to talk about a deemed entity analysis, we'll probably shift between U.S. persons and foreigners. Yeah. And as for the listeners, as you get through it, you'll understand why we're layering that concept in.
Yeah, so for foreigners, you know, I mentioned that if a foreigner foreigners doing stuff on their own, you know, in their own country, the U.S. does not assert jurisdiction over them, okay? And that makes sense. It's just sensible. The IRS is never going to be able to touch some person in France acting solely out of France, right? However, as I mentioned before, a foreigner might choose to hire a U.S. asset manager. And in my, you know, in my practice, I represent a lot of, you know, hedge funds and private equity funds managed by people who are in the U.S. And, you know, they're managing money on behalf of foreigners. So let's say a foreigner hires an asset manager to trade ETH and BTC on their behalf. In that case, the foreigner might very well be deemed to be in a U.S. business. That's actually a term of art, because of the manager's U.S. business, the business of trading ETH and BTC. And then there's a question, is the foreigner subject to US tax? Now, thankfully for us, there is a statutory exemption that says that trading stocks, securities, or commodities for your own account is not a US business if you're a foreigner. So we try to sort of, you know, we try to force ETH and BTC into the commodities, you know, definition for this purpose to be able to conclude that, you know, that an asset manager can trade ETH and BTC on behalf of a foreigner without causing the foreigner to be subject to U.S. tax. That I think is an easy analysis when it comes to ETH and BTC, because we have like futures traded that reference ETH and BTC, which sort of tends to prove for tax purposes, at least, that they're commodities. It's a lot harder when you get to other types of tokens that don't have futures traded for them.
All right. So what about tokens that resemble like Solana or SHIB?
Yeah. So you know, there it really...
And I'm not putting them in the same bucket. No, I'm putting them in separate buckets for the
You're
listeners.
You're going to get a lot of Solana Maxi hate mail today. This is sort of a practical analysis. And for my, you know, practical judgment, I would say it would be very difficult and problematic from a policy perspective for the government to say BTC and ETH are commodities that are entitled to the securities commodities trading safe harbor, but Solana is not, right? It's intended to be virtually the same thing. It's a layer one token with money like properties, you know, consensus layer, and the fact that there aren't futures that explicitly reference Solana, I think is not sufficient to make Solana sort of different enough from BTC and ETH to be kicked out of the commodities trading safe harbor. Shiba Inu is an interesting example, is an interesting like step along the spectrum, because there it's something that's sort of intended to be fungible, intended to be money-like, but is not a consensus layer token. So it does have properties that are fundamentally different from BTC and ETH, which are sort of like baseline commodities. I would still say that, you know, for what it's worth, SHIB is probably a commodity for purposes of the safe harbor. Frankly, I don't know how many asset managers are trading Shiba Inu on behalf of foreign whales, but
yeah, it shares a bucket with some others of similar nature. And what about stablecoins?
Yeah, so stablecoins are interesting. I mean, if you have a stablecoin that is, you know, that tracks the US dollar and does so, you know, well, not all of them do very well, but if it does a good job at it, then it doesn't really matter, right? Because if you sell something worth a dollar, like you're not going to have any gain or loss. However, what about stablecoins that reference, you know, other currencies? I would say those are probably commodities for purposes of the trading safe harbor. There's a lot of guidance suggesting that foreign currencies, like the actual underlying foreign currencies, are commodities. So, you know, by analogy, you know, you sort of have to think that a foreign currency backed stablecoin is either a commodity or maybe a security, like in that, you know, it's sort of a deemed stock in like a money market fund or something.
Excellent. So, and what about, you know, we talked a little bit about NFTs, but where they're isn't a communal you know, treasury, it's like an NFT in the, you know, in the maybe the like your shirt, you
yeah
know,
yeah, your... yeah yeah. So my shirt actually includes a communal treasury, so that's sort of interesting, but so NFTs raise a really interesting question for US taxpayers and foreigners for that matter. So for US taxpayers, we're subject to a normal 20%, you know, long-term capital gains rate, right? Which is a preferential rate. You know, our individual rates for like short-term and for ordinary income go up to 39%, right? Even higher when you include the Medicare tax. For collectibles, the long-term capital gains rate goes up to 28%. So all other things being equal, I would generally prefer something to not be a collectible than to be a collectible if I want to hold it for over a year. Now, unfortunately, the term collectible is not well defined in the tax code. So a collectible includes any work of art, okay, and any, quote, other, close quote, tangible property specified by the IRS. So a lot of people look at the word other, other tangible property, and they say, wait a second. That other suggests that to begin with, you don't have a collectible unless it's tangible. Right? Because it ends the list and it's like other tangible property. Okay. So none of this is, none of this is collectibles.
Right.
I happen to think that that's sort of an aggressive view. I think Congress just wasn't really thinking about,
no, stop.
Believe it or not, it's possible that they weren't considering blockchain-based tech when they wrote the collectible section. There is an alternative argument though. Like even if you think that, collectibles might include, intangibles, you might conclude that like my crypto is not a work of art. All deference to, the artist Gremlin, I suspect that people are not reporting Pokemon cards as collectibles, even though like they literally are collectibles, just, colloquially. I think for tax purposes, people probably say work of art means work of art. Like if you look at, Merriam-Webster, it'll define work of art as like a work of fine painted, fine arts, sculpture, painting, etc. And arguably like a profile pic doesn't cut it. But look, really, really interesting questions. I actually write about this in an article that's coming out on Thursday for the Bankless Down newsletter, considerations for investing in collectibles. So feel free to, pick that up. For foreigners, the question becomes, can a foreigner hire a U.S. person or multiple U.S. people to trade collectibles on their behalf? And that actually is a really good question that I don't really have the answer to. Because collectible NFTs, whether or not they're collectibles for tax purposes, they're not commodities, right? Like cryptos are not commodities under like any understanding of that term. So, if a foreigner hires, let's say a foreigner invests in a DAO or invests in a partnership or hires a US asset manager directly, and the managers there, the decision makers are in the US and doing a bunch of trading of like PFPs and other NFTs, there's a possibility that that would cause the foreigner to become subject to US tax. They're in a trading business and they're not protected by the commodities or security safe harbor.
Interesting. And you on the whole notion of collectible and works of art, you start to get into some line drawing, right? Because, if you look at Beeple on the one hand, would you say that that's not a work of art?
Right.
I think people would say the IRS would say like, what are you kidding me? And maybe there's an element of how much you spend on it that would sort of be indicative that it's a work of art. And then you get into things like CryptoPunks. Is that a work of art? I mean, it certainly, I think there's a strong argument on each side, but
for sure, And I would say I personally, in my personal taxes, like if I sold, one of my like art blocks curated pieces or something, at a long-term gain, I would probably report it as a collectibles gain because like those are, they're intended to be viewed as works of art.
All right. That's helpful. All right. And that concludes our deemed entity analysis. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Just kidding. So we covered what was not, and now we get into what is likely to be deemed an entity for the purposes of tax. And I guess before even diving into this, we have to ask, we talked a little bit about why it matters. Right. Or maybe you can expand on that a little bit. And then we'll sort of ask a few other questions before we get into the analysis.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually let's take like a PFP project, for example, because I think it's a good way to sort of conceptualize this to begin with. And we could even take a PFP project like Cryptodes. Okay. So, in Cryptodes, we're all buying these toads, right? And then with every sale, some amount of royalty, I don't remember what it is. Let's say 5% of the sale price, goes to seed an on-chain treasury. And that treasury is not really, legally owned by anyone, but it's there. And then the owners of the PFP collectively get to vote on how that treasury is deployed. So they sort of have control over the treasury. And then usually, like, some founders in the projects, hold a multi-sig that actually has access to the treasury. And they basically, like, pinky swear to deploy the treasury in accordance with the votes, right? That's, like, sort of your very standard kind of investment DAO, or other structure. It might, in the case of many PFP projects, the structure might not sort of self-identify as a DAO, but it's effectively a DAO, right? It's this decentralized, autonomous organization that's voting on how to deploy profits. Now, if you stop there, normal tax principles just view that as as an entity. It's a bunch of people who are collectively, earning profit and sharing it in some way. The sharing, it doesn't need to be through distribution. It can be through, just sort of collective, decisions on how to deploy that profit. And they're also sort of, to the extent that there are expenses, they're sharing those. You might not realize it, but, like, if someone, turned around and said, hey, like, the cryptos did me wrong, I'm suing the treasury or something, we don't have these cases yet. We don't have this case law, but I think you could very well find, a court case where, like, someone on behalf of the treasury, on behalf of the DAO or whatever, is sort of representing the interests of that treasury, in the face of some plaintiff, suing for monetary damages. That looks a lot like an entity. And then there are questions, and I think these questions are both, legal and regulatory, and that, like, we have questions that deal with sort of personal liability and tax, and many of them, overlap. So for tax purposes, the question will be, what type of entity do we have, and who are its members? Okay, and like one possibility, let's say in the case of this. This hypothetical that I created loosely based on cryptodes, one possibility is that all of the cryptodes members are partners in a partnership because we all have, like, an equal vote on how the treasury is deployed. An alternative argument is that the only partners are really the multi-sigs because ultimately they can sort of go rogue and ignore the community's wishes and deploy the treasury as they wish. But in either of those circumstances, likelihood is that the IRS, if they thought about it, would say that, whoever the partners are, they're each taxed currently on their share of the treasury's income, which means that every time that there's a royalty credited to that chain, like, each of the five multi-sigs or each of the, 6,969 toads have to include, a fractional, like, in income, a fractional piece of that royalty as ordinary income, as if they were getting it directly, just like they were Renaissance technologies.
And what about if it's taxing the multi-sigs? Does that also mean that it taxed the 6,600?
Yeah,
I forget the number, but it's sixes and nines in there.
69. Everything has to be a meme. If it's the multi-sigs are the members, are the partners, then they're each taxed on, if there's five multi-sigs, they'd each be taxed on 1/5 of the income as it's coming in, versus, if it's, like, if all of the toads are the members, then each one of them would be taxed on 1/69 of each dollar that comes in.
And then for the 1/69, they only pay gains. They don't pay income in that case.
Yeah. So they would pay, like, they would pay, you mean if they were members, if they were, like, partners?
Yeah, they're members, but underneath your scenario, if the multi-sigs are viewed as the partners, then is the ultimate tax consequence of 6969?
So if the multi-sigs are viewed as the partners and, like, the toads are not the partners, then the toads probably own just some property, right? Like, then I would just say my toad is just a picture. It's either collectible for tax or it's just a regular capital asset for tax. And that way I'm not subject to pass through taxation. But there is an entity there, right? Like, anytime there's a shared treasury, for US tax purposes, at least, under current law, there's an entity. And you have to decide what kind of entity and who the members of the entity are.
All right. So before we start to dive into that, So we're going down the rabbit hole of one type of analysis. And before we do that, I kind of want to make sure, like, we talked about why a little bit in terms of the context for it. And we talked a little bit about the easy ones, which, you know, they're commodities, they're securities, or they have an exception from being treated as an entity. Why is that analysis appropriate? In other words, you know, is there a specific, are there specific cases that have come out? Is there specific guidance? Like, you know, in other words, what you're saying, you know, that type of analysis is logical, but just because it's logical doesn't mean it's the correct analysis. And I just want to understand a little bit, you know, why that is the appropriate analysis to follow.
Yeah. So I mean, the tax law has a hair trigger for deemed entity. Like, you know, the regulations literally say, you know, any arrangement or course of dealing, you know, any joint venture for profit, whether or not incorporated, is a deemed entity. And the why, you could think of it as, like, let's say you and I set up a lemonade stand. And we, you know, we each put $100 in, you know, to set up the stand, and the stand start, you know, and the stand uses that $100 to buy lemons. You know, we hire some kid at minimum wage to sell lemons, right? And we each have, you know, one share of stock in this lemonade stand. And the lemons start getting sold. We could, if we were sort of crypto native, maybe we would say, oh, look, each of us only has one share and the share never changes. It's like this tokenized interest in this lemonade stand. So the lemonade stand is earning all this income, but we're not going to report it currently. We're just going to hold our shares. And like this, the treasury in the lemonade stand is going to build. Hopefully, you know, there's going to be a lot of dollars in that eventually. And then I can sell my share of stock for more than what I put in, right? More than my $100, and claim a long-term capital gain. That's just not how the tax law is intended to work. The tax law would say, like, no, you know, you guys are indirectly earning this income currently. Again, it's sort of like the you know, one of the fundamental principles that I laid out earlier. Like, if we own a share of the lemonade stand, we own a share of that lemonade stand's income, if it's a partnership. Or the lemonade stand is a separate taxpayer. It's a corporation, and it has to pay tax on that, you know, on those business profits. And again, it's sort of like this elegant solution to ensure that U.S. business profits are always subject to tax in someone's hands, right? It can't be deferred, and it can't be converted from ordinary income into long-term capital gains.
All right. So I'm going to hate myself for doing this. I'm going to go down the lemonade stand road, but and then it. Hopefully we'll just get back to something more grounded. So taking the lemonade stand, let's say that a bunch of boys and girls, doesn't matter, come upon this lemonade stand. And there are lemons laying all over the ground. Now, you got to work me on analogies, please. So I'm, and they each grab this lemon's on the ground. And this lemonade stand on its own, it just starts to work. It's amazing. It's like it just starts creating and it starts generating this lemonade. And people come up and they're like, oh my God, I can just take the lemonade and I give it a coin and it gives me money. And it's got this inherent self-managing treasury, right? So obviously I'm making the analogy to the DAO. And the people are just on the side saying, yeah, I got this lemon. I don't really know what it is. I know I got it near the lemonade stand, you know. So the point obviously I'm making is, in that case, there's an argument that, like, hey, I'm actually not part of that lemonade making machine that's managing the money. And like the crazy thing is, I'll take a little bit of stuff and then I'll pull back. I swear, I promise I'll pull back. It's like when it runs out of lemonades, it instantly sends a notification to the store. You know, Mr. Wilson comes up with his crate of lemons, drops it, and it has arms that grabs it, throws it back. Serious podcast, everybody. Serious podcast. And the lemons are being tossed into the thing, and Mr. Wilson's paid, and he goes back, and everybody's everything. And the people are just sitting by going, like, I got a lemon. That's it. What do you have? I have a lemon, too. Oh, okay. Oh, look, I got two lemons. How'd that happen? Right? I don't know. So that case, Does the deemed entity analysis work? I have this lemonade stand again, we have to, the analogies are, I'm struggling with a little bit on how they got the lemon to begin with, but no, it all works on its own.
Eric, I love this because I think you're sort of skipping to really my conclusion, which my sort of policy conclusion, which is that the current tax rules don't work for on-chain activities. Ethereum is a programmable substrate for human coordination, right? That's sort of like the axiomatic at this point. You hear it all the time. And it's really true. We have this way of, of programming human coordination across the globe among humans who don't know each other's identities, right? It's all pseudonymous. The tax law always assumes that if you're dealing with people in the ordinary course, you know who they are, so that, parties can collectively deputize someone to, pay taxes if they're representing a corporation, for example, or to file information returns to allow the, the shareholders, the members, the partners to pay their taxes directly in the case of an entity that's treated as a partnership. And the tax law just frankly falls apart when you have people dealing pseudonymously across borders in ways that look like, traditional entities, right? Arrangements that look like traditional entities for U.S. tax purposes. And frankly, we just don't have a framework for thinking about those, those arrangements under current law. And you might say, okay, fine. So let's wipe our hands of it then. Let's just say in that case that any token that would, ordinarily just be treated as an interest in a partnership or an interest in a corporation, because Jason is old school and he grew up in TradFi, he's just thinking about this wrong. Let's just treat all those tokens as just like capital assets, end of story. I think that might be an argument to make, but then you really have to develop that with policymakers, because number one, you're basically saying, kill the corporate tax, right? I mean, you're basically saying, okay, we're going to reimagine our entire financial system and in a way that allows people to effectively just elect out of current taxation of business profits. And again, that might be fine, but it in that case, it requires an actual change in law to effectuate it, right? Like you can't, the IRS is not going to be happy to just say, okay, we now have this new class of instrument that allows people to avoid, current taxation of U.S. business profits. I don't have a better answer than that, really. In the meantime, okay, we're sort of forced to, I think creatively and unfortunately kind of like post hoc often, try to cram what we understand, these current relationships that exist on Ethereum and on other smart contract platforms into these old cubbyholes that were designed by, policymakers who had no idea what blockchain technology did or was capable of.
All right. So with that, maybe we should begin. And I guess maybe even, like many things with tax, it's like you want to begin and then you're like, well, hold it. There's these two other considerations as well. So, or if there were only two. So the U.S. corporation, if it's treated like a U.S. corporation, that's simple. I'm not saying it's simpler, but you have a U.S. corporation, you have a U.S. partnership, but then you also have this a foreign corporation. And because digital assets aren't necessarily confined to a single country, there's some, I guess, good things from a tax perspective to it.
Yeah.
There are some things that people need to be aware of from a U.S. tax perspective. And so maybe even before we're yeah, 42 minutes, we're still getting to the deemed entity analysis. I think we're covering it.
This is good.
Let's talk about, so there's the entity classification itself. There's the U.S. foreign classification. Let's break down maybe a couple of the issues that if you're a foreign corporation, name the foreign corporation, what it means for the U.S. holders.
Yeah. So, right. If you're a U.S. corporation, if some arrangement is a U.S. corporation, it just owes corporate tax. Okay. So, let's put that aside. That might be something that you elect to structure into. Occasionally, it makes sense. Frankly, a lot of DAOs, I believe Friends with Benefit as an example, they structure themselves just as domestic corporations, pay U.S. tax on their profits, and then they can do stuff in the U.S. and they can admit foreign holders, and they don't really have to worry about restricting ownership or anything, because look, there's a taxpayer. Like, the IRS has a taxpayer to go after if they need to collect their piece of the pie. A foreign corporation is a little more dangerous from the FISC's perspective, right? Because a foreign corporation, one that's not organized in the U.S., by default is not subject to U.S. tax, and that obviously makes government officials nervous if the foreign corporation is engaged in a U.S. business. So Congress, according to statute, provided that foreign corporations that are engaged in a U.S. business are subject to U.S. tax, just like U.S. corporations. It's actually worse. They're subject to tax plus a 30% branch profits tax on the after-tax amount. It makes it just stupid to set up a foreign corporation if you're going to be doing primarily U.S. business stuff. So that's number one. Number two is Congress said, oh, but what if Jason and Eric and a bunch of other, U.S. people set up a Cayman entity that like just buys a bunch of stock and securities? We want to continue to ensure that U.S. people are taxed currently on income, especially income that can kind of easily be moved offshore. So another rule for foreign corporations is, even if they're not in a U.S. business, if they hold too much passive stuff, U.S. people are just taxed on a pass-through basis. It's called the Passive Foreign Investment Company rules, or PFIC rules, which are kind of a nightmare for people. Basically, if I own stock in a PFIC, I'm subject to horrible, onerous tax penalties unless I make an election to include in income currently my share of the PFIC's income, which means that the PFIC has to report like its pass-through income over to me. So that, again, assumes centralization at the corporate layer.
And then there's also CFC, control foreign corporations, that has its own...
It gets even worse. So PFICs are sort of, any tiny shareholder that owns stock in a foreign corporation that does too much passive stuff has to elect pass-through tax. And then any big shareholder, like any 10% shareholder in a corporation that's controlled by U.S. people, is automatically subject to pass-through tax. Those two regimes kind of overlap with each other.
Yeah, and both of these, for anybody who's structuring deals with foreign companies, you do any kind of acquisition deal, you can spend a lot of time talking PFIC and CFC. It comes up, and when things change, even post acquisition, you start getting a lot of accountants in the room and paying very close attention to it and saying, okay, what activity are you doing? sometimes it's pass-throughs fine. But a lot of it goes through, particularly for smaller entities, it can be very onerous. Or retail investors, it can be very onerous for, I'm not going to say it's easy for venture firms, but oftentimes, depending on the type of entity, they could have a lot of experience dealing with PFICs. And so it's sort of an operating cost, if you would. But, if it's not something that you do every day, and particularly as a retail investor, it's daunting. There's different things you can do from a tax situation. This podcast isn't about PFIC mitigation. And I don't think I'd have the same number of listeners at the end of the podcast if I started getting into PFIC mitigation. So ultimately, what is the best, tax outcome for a crypto project that falls within this deemed entity analysis? Yeah.
So the best treatment that we can hope for, not always doable, is to treat the deemed entity as a foreign corporation that's not in a U.S. business and is not a PFIC or a controlled foreign corporation. And the reason being that then, you know, number one, the entity is not subject to U.S. tax, right? Because it's a foreign corporation and is not in a U.S. business. And then number two, U.S. taxpayers are not subject to pass-through taxation because it's a foreign corporation, not a partnership, and because it's not a PFIC or a controlled foreign corporation. So you end up having, you know, stock in a foreign corporation that's just like a capital asset. And then you get to say like, oh, great, I just have this capital asset. There's no pass-through taxation. And the underlying entity doesn't owe U.S. tax. That's basically the position we take for like all of our, you know, tokens. I shouldn't say that out loud, I guess. But that's the position most U.S. taxpayers take for tokens, that they're just sort of this undifferentiated property. And unfortunately, it does require some sort of post hoc reasoning to get there, I think.
But I think it's also logical. Like, if you have an investment DAO that's offshore, that's probably passive income, right? So you probably have that problem, you know, or you do you own a securitization vehicle, you know, and you're getting, I mean, that's, you know, that's passive income. But, you know, if it has operating income, that's sort of the magic test. Like, you know, you can't, you know, and that's why sometimes when you structure these things, you make sure on offshore, you're not creating like these nested companies, you know, where one is a holding company, because then the holding company gets that pass through, and now it's passive. So you're like, no, I got to connect it to the operating entity, so it's not a passive entity.
Exactly. So where this starts kind of to, you know, where the rubber hits the road really is drawing that distinction that you're kind of making. It's like, you know, is the thing that we're creating on chain, does it look more like a traditional entity where like there's a real, you know, we think that there's a real risk that the government will come after us and say, hey, there should be pass-through tax here, or there should be entity level tax here, right? Or do you think that you can make a fairly strong argument that like, no, this is really just like some piece of property, and implicitly what the argument you're making there is this piece of property is a foreign corporation stock that's not engaged in the U.S. business and is not a PFIC, so there's no pass-through taxation. I'm just trying to sort of like create the mental frameworks for distinguishing between those two types of projects.
Right. And so now to start to get into it a little bit more, we're going to start to talk about like different types of tokens and what analysis it would fall into, different types of DAOs and what deemed entity analysis it would fall into. And also, I think we touched on NFTs a bit and the differences between them and what deemed entity analysis they would fall into. But, since I just talked a little bit about the investment DAO, let's take an example of an investment DAO that collects NFTs.
Okay. So start small, right? And let's say, you know, let's say like you and me and a, you know, bunch of our lawyer friends, get together and we decide to each put in, you know, $100 worth of Ether into a multi-sig in exchange, or a Gnosis Safe, right? In exchange for tokens, right? And those tokens represent, you know, a flat voting in, you know, whatever that like, you know, multi-sig invests in, right? And we decide that we want that multi-sig to invest in NFTs. So I would say that looks a lot like a traditional collective investment vehicle. Like, you know, take the chain out of it. And, you know, particularly since we all know each other, like, it kind of feels like we're just in a partnership, like an investment partnership. And I would say that there's a high probability that the IRS, that's the view that the IRS would take, meaning that, you know, absent any sort of special tax planning, assuming that we're, you know, under 100 people, and I'll explain why in a minute, our partnership is, our entity is probably a partnership. It's required to file annual tax returns reporting, you know, its income and gain. It doesn't have to pay entity level tax, but it has to give us each a Schedule K-1, which is a report that tells us each our share of its income and gain and like items of deduction. And then we have to factor those in to our own taxes when we file our tax returns.
Okay. And then, so what about when we talked about the 100 person limitation, which for me has a different meaning because the Investment Company Act, but
I guess these things iterate with each other, right?
I mean, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it's not accidental.
Right? Yeah.
What is the tax significance?
Yeah.
So
back in the 80s, partnerships became like a big thing. I think the Boston Celtics became a partnership at one point. Maybe you remember this better than I do. Not to be.
Hey, let's be gentle here.
But you know, like
wearing my Minecraft shirt. Okay, give me a break.
The proliferation of partnerships made Congress really nervous. They realized that, you know, unless they acted fast, soon, you know, IBM and like every other, you know, entity traded on the New York Stock Exchange could convert into a partnership and avoid corporate level tax that way. So what Congress did is they drew a line. They said, okay, if you have like a relatively small group of people, we'll let you be a partnership. But if you have more than 100 partners, so it's like publicly traded at that point, and your income is more than 10% active, meaning like you're doing a business, right? Like you're not just sort of like holding stocks and securities or something, but you're actually, you know, doing a business, such as, you know, possibly regularly trading NFTs. You default to corporation. You're treated as a publicly traded partnership, taxable as a corporation. So like even though tax law does give you some, you know, ability to elect into different treatments, it also sort of pushes you toward different treatments depending on some of the facts and circumstances that exist. You realize like how absurd this all is, right? Once you enter the on-chain world, because the truth is, you know, if we set up a, you know, my hypothetical multisig to invest in NFTs, one, we have to know literally who everyone is who invests in the thing, because we have to be able to give them K-1s, right? Number two, we have to actually get representations from them to the effect that each one of them is only one person, right? Because like, what if instead, like, you know, one of the tokens is actually owned by like, you know, 100 people, like a separate multi-sig that itself is owned by 100 people, right? That blows up our tax analysis. It was just like really screwed up. And you know, the tax laws just have not caught up to that, obviously. They assume that, you know, anytime you're dealing with people, you know who they are.
Right. So if it's over 100, then it just becomes a corporation.
Over 100 and you want like foreigners and you don't want to do regular reporting to people, sometimes you just have to elect a corporation because it's sort of like the best option you have. If you look at not clients of mine, but if you look at like Flamingo Dow or 6529's fund or whatever, I believe that those are actually structured as like LLCs, where the tokens are just, you know, interests in the LLCs and are actually treated as partnership interests and are non-transferable. And each person actually has to sign a rep letter, like saying who they are and that they're not going to transfer, because otherwise there's just no way to do tax compliance. An alternative way that they could have done it is they could have said, okay, we're just going to elect to be, you know, a Delaware C corporation for US tax purposes, and we're going to pay taxes, and then our tokens are transferable, but there's this like inefficiency embedded in there because, you know, at this centralized entity level, we're actually paying a 21% corporate tax before any profits are even released out to anyone else.
Right. Although, you know, the corporation probably gets challenging from an investment company analysis perspective as well. And you know, it raises registration implications. Maybe let's talk about something like a social club that's doing U.S. events.
Yeah. So you might be listening or you know, and saying like, wait a second, this is insane. Like, you know, like I can understand, you know, a bunch of people getting together and investing in NFTs together. Like, sure, they should be taxed on their share of profits from that on a current basis, because, like, you know, if they invested in fine art in the real world, like, it would be the same consequence. But, like, what if they're just getting together to, you know, improve a protocol, or to raise money to give to charity or something? Well, here's the thing. The U.S. doesn't really...
Or maybe they put their money into it and they can get a return, but the main purpose is social events.
Yeah, right. Like, they want to just host social events. They want to, they want to invite people to whatever, to like events where they can display friends' NFTs or something. I don't know. That doesn't really feel like a business for profit, right? But the IRS doesn't really care. Like, and Congress doesn't really care. The general rule is that if you come together and collectively earn profits, then you're in a business entity. And that business entity, is either a partnership or a corporation. And if it's a partnership, then you're all taxed on the income. And if it's a corporation, then it's taxed on the income, right? Assuming the income is from US sources. So one thing that's possible to do, and that some social clubs are doing, is they're actually forming like an entity, a legal entity. And if the legal entity is actually charitable, so the most famous example, I think, would be the Big Green, Big Green DAO, which is run by Kimball Musk. Big Green, the company, is run by Kimball Musk, Elon's brother, and helps teach people about planting gardens and sustainable living and whatnot. And Big Green partners up with Big Green DAO. And Big Green is actually a 501c3. It's a charity. Like, I can, their purpose is explicitly permitted as a charitable purpose in the tax code. I can donate money to Big Green 501c3 and take a tax deduction. And Big Green 501c3 doesn't have to pay corporate income tax, but it does have to file tax returns. And that's one thing I actually do at Fried Frank, pro bono for people. If DAOs want to set up sort of partner 501c3s, we do that pro bono for the DAOs, and the DAO can sort of be kind of like an advisory committee to the 501c3, where the 501c3, this off-chain entity, agrees to act on behalf of the DAO so long as it's consistent with the 501c3's charitable purposes. And that's sort of administrative grace that the government provides to charities, because basically the idea is, Congress can't do all this stuff alone. If you do something that sort of gives back, to the public benefit, and satisfies these requirements, then, we're not going to tax you for that, because that's something that, like, government ideally sort of would have done for its people anyway. However, most social clubs, they're not charitable. Normally setting up events and stuff for, like-minded individuals is not a charitable purpose. And in that case, there's an alternative treatment where you can set up as a 501c7, which is also not subject to income tax, but has other requirements. Like, it can't derive too much of its income from non-members. Like, most of its income has to come from membership dues and whatnot. There are these, like, real requirements. Again, none of this is ideal from the DAO's perspective, because it's highly, highly centralized. But it is an option that some DAOs explore when centralization is not their, ultimate goal, and they want to have a legally compliant, tax-compliant entity.
Right. And taking advantage of some of those exemptions, requires discipline. It's not easily done.
No. Right. And you literally need a centralized hub, right? Where like someone is there in the real world filing tax returns and potentially paying taxes.
Right. Right. So now we'll shift gears to maybe a tougher one, which is protocol DAO governance tokens.
Yeah. So like this is where we're basically just in the Wild West, right? And like maybe the way to start is actually think about just a smart contract generally, and then think about a protocol DAO as sort of governance over you know, multiple smart contracts, right? So like I'm writing an article right now for probably next month's, you know, Bankless newsletter. And so here's my teaser, and this is sort of my framework thinking about this. Think about a curve pool, like the three pool and curve, right? Curve is an automated market maker, specifically geared towards stable coins. And in the three pool, you know, you have three stable coins, right? DAI, USDC, and USDT. And basically on the front end, like traders can come to the pool and the pool will quote them algorithmically a price for swapping DAI for USDC or DAI for Tether or whatever you have. And the pool earns a fee on every swap, right? And that's also all algorithmically quoted. And where does the liquidity come from to do those swaps? Well, it comes from liquidity providers, right, on the back end. So, you know, I can contribute those three stable coins into the pool on the back end in exchange for an LP token, a liquidity provider token. And my LP token, just like, you know, your LP token or anyone else's, just represents a share of whatever's in the pool, which is like this constantly changing proportions of stable coins plus fees. Right. Under normal U.S. tax principles, you know where I'm going with this. The LP tokens look like equity in an entity, right? Because like the three pool is this thing. It's this enterprise that's doing something. This something is actually, you know, think about it. It's a bank. It's a dealer. Like this thing is doing what JP Morgan does on a daily basis. Right. But it's not paying corporate taxes. And the profits are being split by the LP holders, right? Each LP token represents a share, hopefully ever-growing share, of profits. So for tax purposes, if you applied the tax law sort of woodenly to to the three pool, you would say, oh shit, the three pool is an entity. The LP tokens are its equity. And you then have to decide, is the entity a domestic corporation? If so, it needs to be paying taxes, and it's clearly not. Is it a foreign corporation? You know, presumably that's what people are treating it as. And presumably they're saying it's not in a U.S. business, so it doesn't owe U.S. taxes. And presumably they're saying it's in this like dealer activity that's not generating passive income, it's generating active income, and it's all done offshore so that it's, you know, again, not in a U.S. business and it's not a passive foreign investment company, so that my LP tokens are just stock in a foreign corporation and I'm not subject to, you know, pass-through tax.
Right. And there's definitely some strangeness to applying that, particularly to like an AMM or a curve pool, because, you know, if you think about like a corporation, or you think even about an LLC, an LP, it's basically, it's like there's a profit and all the members are sharing and they sort of have this cooperative type relationship, if you would. Like there's a bucket, money comes in, I take the pieces out. But in fact, in these pools, that relationship doesn't actually exist.
Exactly.
Right? It's sort of like taking a big flat balloon and filling it a little bit with water. And, you know, you push here and something pops out there, or like a waterbed or whatever. It's like the relationship of the participants in the pool. I mean, you could have participants in a pool whose interests are directly opposed to one another.
Yes.
And one person's gain could be another one's loss. So within that pool, there's a whole dynamic marketplace in some ways, shape, or form. You could almost argue it's a marketplace, although it's not. The marketplace is really how it phases out. But within the pool, there's dynamics.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Right.
That's exactly right. And that's sort of the problem, I think. Like, that's the heart of the problem, that under traditional tax principles, you have entities kind of everywhere on chain. But like really, that's not how they should be treated, because there's something different about what we're doing here. And that's something different is like, really, we've injected kind of the gig economy into entities, where now everyone is really acting on their own behalf, and more so than, like, you know, there are different factions of shareholders in a corporation. Like, there's something different. It's hard to articulate, but I think you did a good job of it, where, like, right, really everyone views themselves as acting on their own behalf, not on behalf.
Well, we liken corporations to persons, but in a pool, what person goes down the street punching themselves in the nose, tripping, walking into different, like, there's nothing, there's no coordinated profit purpose
exactly
with that entity, right?
Exactly.
So now, I probably had it better before. I didn't have to go to punching myself. It just, I did the lemonade stand, so I had to kind of tie back to something for people who like the lemonade stand.
You're a great tax professor. Take the Curve pool and you know, expand this a little. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble. Curve is not a client, by the way. I'm just sort of pulling something, you know. like, continue thinking about this and consider the CRV tokens. So, like, you have these pools and there's sort of these auto-executing things that kind of look like corporations for tax purposes. And then you have the CRV token, which itself, like, you know, it's emitted by the pools, right? And then if I take my CRV tokens and I lock them up, I lock up my CRV token with the Curve protocol, I get some voting rights, right? And I get more voting rights. I get, if I lock up, you know, one CRV, I get one, you know, VE CRV, vote escrowed CRV, if I agree to lock up my CRV for, I think, 4 years or something. And if I lock it up for 3 years, maybe I get, you know, 0.75 VE CRV, et cetera. But I get some voting rights. And now, as a voter, I get a few things. Number one, I get, I share more fees, right? I get streaming fees from all of the, like, Curve pools. Right, those go directly to me. They get credited to my account on Curve. And then number two, I get, like, boosted rewards from the particular pools that I'm providing liquidity to. And then number three, I get to vote on operation and future proposals for the Curve protocol. Now, explain that to the IRS, and I suspect that even if, like, some, you know, auditors there, or, you know, or higher ups there, could sort of get over the hump and say, like, okay, maybe LP token holders are not equity holders in a company. Like, maybe that's something else. I am concerned that they'll say, oh wait, but, like, these Curve people, like, these VE CRV holders, like, they're clearly holders in an entity, because they're actually, like, they have the ability to change the entire protocol. Like, any one of them can make a proposal, and then they vote on it, and they're sharing profits from, like, the entire protocol. That starts looking like you're, like, multinational company, right? But at the same time, like, it does have a ton of similarities to the smart contract, where, you know, notwithstanding that we're sort of all acting in concert, at the same time, like, in the way you described it, Eric, you know, maybe I'll let you try it again, but, like, at the same time, we're sort of not, right? At the same time, like, I don't really view myself as a partner with you by virtue of the fact that we might both have Curve tokens, right?
Right. Right.
So it's, we're in this, like, really uncharted territory, and I don't know. I just frankly don't know how the tax rule will deal with it. On one hand, you might have to say, yeah, like, VE CRV holders are all shareholders in a deemed entity that is what? I don't know. I mean, a foreign corporation, I guess, that's not engaged in U.S. business. But, like, if you're setting up a protocol, you might actually want to plan into that treatment, because otherwise you're in this real no man's land. And what do I mean by plan into that treatment? Well, if you're, like, setting up, you know, the next version of Curve protocol, you might want to consider taking measures to ensure that, like, it really is not engaged in a U.S. business. How do you do that? Well, maybe, like, one way is, anytime you deploy a contract to the chain, make sure that that contract is not deployed by a U.S. person. Like, I don't know. That's really hard, I know, when you're like voting in this decentralized way. But if you do have multi-sigs, maybe you make sure that, like, they're not U.S. so that, you know, they're not doing stuff in the U.S. But frankly, I'm just sort of making this stuff up. I don't have clear answers. I just know that this is potentially like the next tax frontier to be explored by the IRS.
And yeah, I mean, it's the complexity there is that by choosing multi-sigs that aren't in the U.S. or not deploying in the U.S., I mean, if the IRS says, yeah, that's good as long as you do that, that's sort of like, okay, is that what we really want to achieve? Is that the
terrible policy?
Is that the policy outcome we want? I mean, there's a lot of policy questions, which both tax and securities obviously raises. And like, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, we set up a foundation structure offshore. You know, it's memberless. We do, you know, we use the Cayman Foundation structure or similar structures to reflect the fact that it is memberless. These are smart contract governed. There's no evasionary tactic. It reflects the reality of what it is. And whether it's Cayman Foundation or otherwise, you know, sure, you don't have to necessarily condone it in the U.S., so to speak, because, you know, whatever. But the practical matter is we are trying to achieve decentralization, and it is consistent with what the smart contract does. But that makes sense. But when you start to get into these nuances of who can be the multisig or who can deploy the code, I mean, really, like, oh crap, our tax treatment is destroyed, you know, like, right. Oh crap, I will send you the file, you know, and you're in, you know, India, and then you receive it and you hit send. Oh, yeah. Shoot. We dodged that bullet. Thank God, you know, they saved.
No, you're sort of proving the point that the current tax rule clearly didn't contemplate this stuff, right? And I think we just need new tax law to address this stuff. Unfortunately, I'm not optimistic that, you know, that most of this can be addressed by like regulation or something, you know, even though I have a great deal of respect for a lot of people at Treasury, I what I'm describing is really like a change in law issue that would have to be considered. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it makes the tax law isn't only kind of impossible to apply to many decentralized relationships, but it also, to the extent you do try to apply it, it yields like absurd policy results that, you know, clearly couldn't have been intended by Congress.
And the fact of the matter is it may be that like the guy who hit send instead of like, I meant to send it to India or whatever, it doesn't, whatever, yeah. But I meant to send it abroad to my partner somewhere else, you know, just stupid things like that. But yet,
yeah,
you know, sometimes in these scenarios, you know, some entities may get it, may slip up and others may not. And if you're the IRS and you're looking for a head to roll, like which one are you going to point to? You're going to be like, well, you did deploy it in the US. Yeah, but that was an accident. I hit send. I was drinking coffee and I was cleaning off my keyboard and I accidentally hit send. You know, it's like, well, you know, that sounds great, but what should I have done? You know, the obvious, you know?
Yeah. And that is frankly a huge part of the job of a lawyer at a big law firm, which is sort of ensuring, you know, not just tax
or a small law firm.
Yeah, right. Lawyers,
but not on the tax side. Yeah,
you know, we say, oh, I want to be middle of the road, right? I don't want to be the low hanging fruit for a regulator. So, you know, even when we're operating in kind of no man's land, you know, we try to take reasonable positions that at least put us in middle of the road, so that, you know, if you know, a regulator does wake up to this and say, oh, you know, like there's all this tax revenue that we can grab if we just like make, you know, this particular assertion, you know, that you fall sort of, you know, slightly to one side of that assertion.
And so, you know, on this point with the protocol tokens, what has your experience been talking to people within the IRS, you know, on behalf of clients? Because I'm sure you seek out guidance and on a no names basis, of course. What has been, I mean, it, you know, it, I'm sure there's a recognition of some of the challenges in the regulation, and that if you ask for interpretations, they'll say, well, you know, I can't guarantee you, but based on today, you know, and the last thing you want is like a formal guidance, right? Then you'll wait 2 years and your client will want to kill you or whatever. I don't know what the timing is. You can tell me, but what's been your experience in sort of asking these questions to the IRS, both in the context of formal guidance when necessary, or informal guidance?
You are very optimistic. I've spoken a lot with Treasury representatives, and I speak on panels regularly. I spoke at the American Bar Association tax section meeting a few weeks ago. I'm speaking at the New York State Bar Association tax section summer meeting in a few weeks. Both government officials attend these meetings. They are nowhere near the point at which they are ready to comment on these sorts of relationships, like protocol DAO tokens and what they are. And I don't think, you know, they're not even ready to comment on like liquidity provider tokens, like, you know, like LP tokens in Curve or entity type concerns arise for like Compound C tokens and Lido, you know, wrapped state ETH, et cetera. They're not ready to speak about any of this, unfortunately. And you know, as smart as they are, in particular, I would give a shout out to Erica Ninehouse, who is a former practitioner at Cleary. She really, really knows financial products and has done a lot of thinking, I think, while at the government about digital assets. To me, it seems like the IRS, you know, notwithstanding those efforts, is still potentially years away from really thinking about these relationships deeply. I mean, look, they can't even decide whether like consensus layer staking rewards are taxable on a current basis yet. I mean, I know you had Abe Sutherland on in a prior podcast, and you guys talked about that a lot. I don't know if that was before or after the IRS, you know, gave Jarrett's their refund, and then like
before,
right? So since then, you know, the IRS refunded them their money, and then filed a motion to dismiss so that the IRS wouldn't have to give guidance, right, on whether or not consensus layer staking rewards are taxable currently. That's how far we are. Like we're still talking about, you know, base layer, sort of the most basic transaction you can do on Ethereum, right?
Yeah, I mean, that case was amazing because it was like, you know, it came out and everybody's like, yeah! It's like, no. That's
right. We have zero.
They are dodging. They are saying, I'm not answering the question today, yeah. Okay?
Yeah. I will put out a plug for, you know, legislators like Senators Gillibrand and Lummis, who, recently released their crypto bill. And it's an effort, I think a pretty darn good effort at a comprehensive, legislative framework for digital assets. It doesn't answer a lot of these questions, but at least it, would, if enacted, sort of prod regulators to think more about it. And I think just the fact that you have a bipartisan bill on the table now, you will have more policymakers thinking about this stuff. So this might be a good opportunity for the industry to sort of come together and start thinking about, places where they need clarity from policymakers. I think one place where we really, really need clarity is tax. And I'm not talking just about like 6050i and stuff like the broker reporting rules, which, you know, did get us all, you know, up in a frenzy a year or so ago. But I'm talking about, you know, something that I think is pretty fundamental, which is like, are we all in entities or is there some new type of property that digital assets create that allow us to, you know, take the position that we just are holding and trading a bunch of capital assets? And I would love for it to be the latter, but I don't know how we get there necessarily under current law.
Right. Right, which is sort of the point of the deemed entity analysis. So, yeah. We talked a little bit about LP tokens. We could certainly talk about it more, but let's talk a bit about staked ETH. and how you would characterize that under a deemed entity analysis.
Yeah.
Or similar, I guess, what, like Aave tokens or...
Yeah. So I actually wrote about this quite a bit. And most recently in last month's Bankless DAO newsletter. Anytime I have a thought, by the way, I just publish it to Bankless DAO's newsletter. That's why
he's not plugging Bankless DAO's newsletter.
Yeah, I'm not.
Read the Bankless DAO newsletter. Yeah. Read the Bankless DAO newsletter, all listeners.
It's called, I think, the latest DeFi alpha is tax optimized staking, and it was in last month's issue, so May issue, and I talk about the differences between I sort of create this framework one where I distinguish between what I call liquid staking and what I call illiquid staking. Terrible names, but as I say in the article, I am a tax lawyer, not a marketer. What I mean by liquid staking is anytime you deposit a token in exchange for another token that represents a share in a pool, okay? So I talked about Curve LP tokens already. That would be liquid staking. Wrapped staked ETH on Lido would also be liquid staking. Compound tokens would be liquid staking, right? So Compound, you put liquidity in, and then the smart contract, lends your liquidity out and earns interest, and you own a C token, which basically represents this, hopefully ever-growing share of this, or this share of a hopefully ever-growing pie, right? Right, like whatever is going on inside the smart contract. And I distinguish that from illiquid staking. By illiquid staking, I mean you might or might not take back a token when you contribute to a smart contract, but whatever you get back is not a token that represents a share in an ever-changing pool. So, like, for example, on Lido, you might stake ETH in exchange for STETH, right? Staked ETH. But one STETH is just a bailment token. It's just like the right to get back ETH, that the amount of ETH that you staked to begin with. It's not a share in a pool that's changing. It's just one for one ratio, right? And I call that illiquid staking. It's liquid, obviously, because you can trade the STETH, but like your actual rewards, your future rewards are not liquid. Those just get credited to your wallet, on a current basis. So they're not sort of conveniently wrapped in a token that can be transferred. So what I say is that under traditional tax principles, liquid staking looks like an entity because, it looks like stock in a corporation. You have this thing, this wrapped staked ETH or, rocket pool ETH or, C tokens or whatever. And it's this share in this pool that is doing stuff like a business. Whereas illiquid staking, it doesn't feel as much like you're sharing with other people. It feels more like a securities loan of some sort. Like you've loaned out your ETH, you've posted it as collateral to someone or something like that. And in exchange, you're earning this constant fee revenue. And there I say, maybe you don't have an entity, but you're taxed currently on the rewards. So like there's this like tax difference where, if you have an interest in an entity, then, as we've been saying for the last, whatever hour, as long as this podcast has been going, like you have to figure out their consequences. And most people seem to be saying, well, that entity is probably a foreign corporation. That's not a PFIC. So no pass-through tax. Whereas if you do illiquid staking, you maybe don't have an interest in an entity, but you're getting current rewards and you're taxed currently at ordinary income rates on those rewards as they come in. So different tax treatment, probably different tax consequences.
Awesome. Well, Jason, thanks so much for coming up on an hour and a half. I knew it'd be a substantive podcast, but I also, I think the way you break it down makes it a lot more easy than what people would expect a tax lawyer to do, right? Like, throw out a bunch of citations. People just like, huh?
Yeah.
I do my best.
Excellent. I also don't have a good memory for citations. So,
that works to your favor on a podcast. Exactly. Sometimes. Because nobody's going to sit there going, oh, hold it. He said rule 80, the form 8300. Let me flip through. Oh, yeah. You know, right. And we don't do the whiteboard. We don't do the projection screen on this either. We do the faces. This is a podcast. Yeah. So. Excellent. So once again, thanks so much. And so if people, so we know a little bit, I typically say, if people want to get in touch with you, where can they go? They can certainly go to the Bankless newsletter, which he writes every month. And where else can they find you?
Yeah. I mean, you can look me up. I'm a tax partner and head of digital assets at Fried Frank. It's spelled Fried Frank, like a corn dog. You can also add me on Twitter at CryptoTaxGuyETH. And I'm pretty readily available, fully doxed everywhere. CryptoTaxGuy.eth.
There you go. Well, thanks so much. You take care.
All right. Thanks for having me. Take care.